So last time, we were talking about something that probably is not the most interest in the world to some, and it, if you read much of it, it's just a royal pain, really, because it's a bunch of nonsense. But the schoolmen, by the schoolmen, I mean those are the men that of the Middle Age, medieval scholasticism. And so we were talking about that a little bit. I'm not going to bog us down here for very long. Took a little longer with it in the course that I taught at TBDI, but there's no need for us to really do that much. I just remind you that Christianity was born into a very philosophical world. The parts that left the Bible were quickly corrupted by Plato. Platonism, which was basically Gnosticism. And of course, the Catholic Church developed over a few hundred years, and along comes Augustine, and he was a heretic, in spite of what you might have heard. But then as things went into the Middle Ages, and we're talking here in this time frame, from the 1,000-year to the 1,500-year time frame. So we're in the heart of the Middle Ages now. And what the schoolmen dealt with, these are, folks, these are not Bible people. These are philosophers that were just out to justify the Catholic Church. That's all they did. And I'll give you some names in a minute and tell you just in rough terms what they believed. We're not going to spend much time with it. But whereas Christianity was born into a world of Platonism and Gnosticism, the medieval days during this 1,000-year to 1,500-year time frame, they went to Aristotle, and Aristotle had not been translated into their language in days past, but by the time, you know, the year 1000 or 1100 rolled around, Aristotle had been translated, and so now they started trying to conform everything to Aristotle. They tried to justify the Catholic, Roman Catholic doctrines by Aristotle. And what you just need to remember is the Bible says, beware lest any man spoil you through philosophy and vain deceit. And what these guys, what these guys are philosophers. They are philosophers who are simply out to justify the Catholic Church and all of its heathen nonsense. And so that's what they're trying to do. They're not trying to go to the Bible and get more light from the Bible. They're taking issues the Catholic Church already believes and trying to justify those issues by reason and by philosophy. And so, you know, you heard a little bit on Sunday, I think, about how the philosophy even reached into the revolutionary era of our country. And at every turn, what philosophy does is mess people up. And the reason why is because your mind, no matter how smart you are, your mind is incapable of grasping God and coming to conclusions about God without revelation. And that's what they did. That's what they did. That's what people have always done, whether it be Plato or whether it be a Catholic who's calling himself a schoolman, a scholastic. And some of these guys were reportedly brilliant. You couldn't tell by what they wrote because they write like morons. But it only goes to show you that very intelligent men without any revelatory guidance are useless. They're useless. So the schoolmen only intended in reconciling Roman Catholic doctrine with reason and philosophy, and that's what they're doing. Now, again, I'm not going to bog us down here because I don't want to. For instance, I didn't write their names up here, but you probably have heard, if you've done much reading around Catholic stuff, you probably heard of a guy named Anselm, A-N-S-E-L-M. Now, he's living in the 1000s, so 1,000 up to 1,100, sometime in that time frame. And what he said was that faith precedes knowledge. He was also known as the second Augustine. And he said that the teaching of the church and the Bible are in complete agreement, which only shows that he never even read the Bible. Because they're not in complete agreement. Any moron knows that they read it for the first time. They're not in complete agreement. So His arguments as to the existence of God were philosophical and proved utterly nothing. He just tried to justify what the Catholic Church had already written. His theory on the atonement was called the satisfaction theory, for instance. It said that God's honor had to be satisfied at Calvary rather than his holiness. Whatever. But he was a philosopher who was in from the realist school. All these guys are primarily philosophers who are trying to reconcile Catholicism with their philosophical reason. Another guy was Peter Abelard. You'll know his name if you've read any Catholic material much. Again, he was primarily a moderate realist, although a Catholic. And this guy seduced a 17-year-old girl while he was supposed to be, you know, tutoring her. And by the time it's all said and done, it becomes a profound scandal until the girl's uncle tracks him down and operates on him, and then he moves into a monastery. That's all I'll say. But it's a royal mess. He taught, and by the way, he never tried to reconcile what he'd done to this girl. Her name was Heloise, but he believed in the moral influence theory that man, by Christ's death, is moved to love God because he so loved us. And he said that sin lies in the intentions. For instance, those who killed Christ, thinking they were doing right, did no sin. That's what guys get when they get thinking too much. It's exactly what happens, and this is supposed to be a real smart guy. A guy named Bernard of Clairvaux, he was a mystic monk, and he talked his sister into becoming a nun after she was married. So he converted her to being a nun after she had a husband. So, anyway. Guy named Peter Lombard. Now again, he's a modern realist, so another branch of philosophy. He's known as the father of systematic theology in the Roman Catholic Church. He taught baptismal generation. So when you got baptized, you got saved. When you baptized a baby, that baby was introduced into the family of God. And he believed the Lord's Supper is a sacrifice that is transmuted into the body and blood. So you eat the wafer and you swallow the blood and it becomes part of your body and part of your blood. And you've partaken of eternal life when you've eaten the wafer. So that's what he believed. Now these are people that are supposed to be smart. And they can't figure out that that's cannibalism. They can't figure out that when the priest lifts the wafer, dings the bell, and changes it, that he's practicing witchcraft. And that he's a charlatan. Because none of that ever happens. So these are really smart people now. Here is Albertus Magnus. He's known in history as Albert the Great. He is known as the Universal Doctor. He was a German moderate realist. So again, a branch of philosophy. He was Thomas Aquinas' master, if that matters to you. I'll talk about him in a second. But he was known as Aristotle's ape, A-P-E, Aristotle's ape, because all he could talk about was Aristotle. Albert Magnus wrote over 27,000 pages, and over 1,000 of those pages were spent slobbering over Mary being the mediatrix between men and God. And so that gives you an idea of, you know, how great he really was. Thomas Aquinas, by the way, St. Thomas Academy is named after Thomas Aquinas, not Doubting Thomas. Thomas Aquinas was Albertus's pupil. He is the prince of the schoolmen. This guy is, they ding his bell as one of the most intelligent, brilliant schoolmen of all time. His mind was right up there with Origins and all that stuff, which indicates that you should get away from him. by the way. He's known as the angelic doctor, the prince of the schoolmen. He is placed up there with Augustine and John Calvin as a theological mastermind. He taught that unbaptized children go to hell. Not limbo, hell. He believed in all seven sacraments. Now, this guy is brilliant. He is intelligent beyond any of us, I'm sure. But he still believes in seven sacraments. And he believes that little kids go to hell if they didn't get dunked in water or sprinkled. He believed in baptismal regeneration, the transubstantiation. He believed that with proper penance that you could redeem yourself from your sins. And more than anything else, he believed in papal supremacy. That is, that whatever the Pope said went. That he was the ruler of the church and of all nations, and that what the Pope said is the final word. So that was Saint Thomas Aquinas. You may have heard of a guy named John Bonaventure. You would if you read Catholic material, for sure. But he left thousands of pages and just glowing descriptions of Mary and all that she could do for men. It's ridiculous. Roger Bacon was called the father of the scientific method of investigation, but he still believed in transubstantiation. He was supposed to be one of the first real scientists and all those things. And by the time you get up to his era, things are starting to change over into the Renaissance. And so there's a little glimmer of light. The Renaissance is not like a real regeneration of anything, but men started breaking off from the Catholic Church, and Roger Bacon at least taught some things about the Bible that were right, but he still believed in transubstantiation. So it's these guys, you know, just because you hear some good stuff about Luther, don't think he was a great guy. He didn't want to not be a Catholic. All he wanted was to get away from the indulgences. That was what he protested against. He still believed that the Catholic Church should have every right to kill heretics. In fact, by the time he's the one that started the Protestant Reformation, they say. By the time it's all over, when a bunch of Bible believers started taking what he taught and running with it, doing right by the gospel, by the Bible, he wanted to kill them. So just because one of these guys believes something kind of like you do, just because everybody else is in complete darkness doesn't mean you should follow them. I'll give you an example, just a few examples of some of the things that these... I got to use this still. Yeah, there you are. I've always wanted one of those. Anyway, Scholasticism, they debated all kinds of things. They debated what would happen if a mouse ate the Eucharist after it had been consecrated. Now, these brilliant dudes spent hundreds of pages debating what might happen if a mouse. I promise, somewhere along the way through the Middle Ages, a rat or a mouse did get a hold of some consecrated bread. I can promise you that. Anyway, by the way, they debated what hour of the day was it that Adam sinned. So you can see where this leads. It's just speculation. And you know, they're not going to the Bible and finding a type or anything like that. They're too stupid to do that. They're just debating what time, you know, that kind of stuff would happen. Don't forget the debate over, since Mary remained a perpetual virgin, don't forget the alternate birth canal debate that they had, because they were serious about this. And finally, this is the last one I have. Will a man in the resurrection... what are you laughing at? Will a man in the resurrection recover all of his fingernail and toenail clippings? So, they debated this. Anyway, I'm telling you. Now, The answer to scholasticism in the medieval period was not the Bible. But there are some other guys that rose up. And remember, the Renaissance is creeping up. By the time you get to the 1350s, the Renaissance is creeping in. And part of the Renaissance was men desiring to have light that they hadn't had because the Catholic Church had kept them in darkness all this time. Now, the other part of it was just men wanting to go and fornicate and do what, you know, men want to do and all that stuff. So that's part of the Renaissance too. But some of these guys, there are some guys that contributed to the opposite of scholasticism. One such fellow was a guy named Royce Brook. He believed in spiritual intoxication, spiritual hysteria. And all these guys are doing is instead of being rigorously lorded over by the Catholic Church, they're breaking free and saying, no, we should be following our own, you know, it's kind of like the Michael Landon gospel. It's following our own hearts, following our own desires. And so they're trying to follow this inner light and all that kind of stuff. It's called mysticism. A guy named Thomas A. Kempis is somebody else that you would know the name of if you read very much Catholic material. Brother Mark, I think, went to St. Thomas, so he would have heard of Thomas A. Kempis. But he wrote The Imitation of Christ. It was a devotional manual loved by both Protestants and Catholics, including the Jesuits. And he was monkish in his writing, and he still supported transubstantiation and all that stuff. But that's about all the light you get from that. Now, I wanted to get out of that and go to witchcraft, because what's happened is that now you're in the 1300 to 1400 AD era. It's the heart of the Middle Ages. It's the darkest of the Dark Ages. And keep in mind here, the Roman Catholic Church has propounded and set forth its fables for all these years. It's taken a bunch of lost heathen, converted them to Catholics. Of course, there's no regeneration. They've just flipped the gods and turned it into Jesus Christ, and they've just taken bits and pieces of heathenism so that they can satisfy these folks in church and put it into these big fancy buildings and stuff. And so then along come the schoolmen, and they justify everything that the Catholic Church has taught and go into it at tremendous depth. So it's no surprise, since Catholicism practices witchcraft, if what they do is what they claim, that is witchcraft. The popes have for generations propounded lies and mystical nonsense. And so sometime around the 1300s, there was a sweeping thing that happened in Europe where people became just crazed over witchcraft. By that I mean that wherever they looked, they found a witch. There were things that were going on, and I don't doubt for a minute that some of it was genuine. I mean, Brother Dave just got back from Haiti, and I've never been there, but I know that there's real, genuine, weird stuff that goes there that's real. Now, at the same time, you know, with the Catholic Church's a pretense and all of their mystical nonsense, then some of it's going to be lies and just charlatanism too. But the bottom line is it just kind of swept through Europe, this issue of witchcraft, where everybody was scared of it and all those sort of things. That was about from starting about the 1300s. Let me pick up something here to read for you real quick. Again, it's not something I'm going to spend a lot of time with, but there have been a couple of these in history, and this was something that all the writers write about, if I can find the right page. Okay. The credulity of monk and people and the theology of the schoolmen peopled the earth and the air with evil spirits. the writings of popular authors teem with tales of their personal appearances and malignant agency. The scholastic definitions are nowhere more precise and careful than in the department of Satanology. After centuries of Christian, he's calling this a Christian culture, of course it's not, it's Catholic culture. But after centuries of Christian culture, a panic seized upon Europe in the first half of the 13th century, almost the about the fell agency of such spirits, a panic which continued powerfully to influence opinion far beyond the time of the Reformation. The persecution to which it led was one of the worst and most merciless forms of cruelty ever practiced. The pursuit and execution of witches constitute a special chapter in the history of the church, but it is not fully open until the 15th century. The sources from which the Middle Ages derived their ideas of the demonic world were the systems of classical antiquity, the Norse mythology, the Bibles interpreted by Augustine and Gregory the Great. Of course, they've incorporated all these heathen ideals, the Gothmen, the barbarians, and everything else. They've all put this in a pot and let it stew. And now with Catholicism's lies and pretense, they've turned it into this monster that breeds Satanism. And so in its wildest fancies on the subject, the medieval theology was only following the two greater authorities. It goes through, you know, all the things that the monks all believe. Look, the monks are all living in monasteries, a bunch of flea-bitten, lice-infested dudes who are demon-possessed anyway, and they're seeing all kinds of things happen. They're supposed to be quote-unquote celibate. Half of them aren't, and you know they're basically living demonology. And so a lot of stuff is going on. The popes pressed this thing hard because it was to their advantage to do so. I mean, in the end, they want to kill a bunch of people. But pick up a place to read here. In the monasteries, the devil was often seen in the forms of a moor, M-O-O-R, an ox, a dog, a toad, an ape, a pig, and even in the garbs of a nun and a prior. Yeah, I bet. Peter the Venerable likewise speaks of Satan as taking on the form of a bear. He also assumed the forms of a black horse and other creatures. French poetry and the popular imagination invested him with horns, claws, and a tail. And this goes on, I'm not reading anywhere near all of this. In fact, I can't read some of this, but it was a, well, I can't read that one. Sorry. By the way, the sign of the cross, spitting and saying the Ave Maria were sufficient to usually drive him away. I'm not sure what the spitting had to do with it, but, Peter the Venerable gives many cases showing how the crucifix, the host, and the holy water protected monks insidiously attacked by the children of malediction, that is the demons. So again, this is obviously nonsense. The Huns, now these are the barbarian Huns, Mongols and Huns, were popularly believed to be the offspring of demons and off-caste Gothic women. What they started dealing with was questioning whether a baby was born of a demon or not. And people got so carried away with the fear and panic of what was going to happen that many times people, well, they couldn't have babies. And so, they would put them under torture to find out if they were demon-possessed. And of course, if they determined they were, they'd kill them. They'd torture them. So, I mean, this is really black, dark times. And there's some of this stuff I can't even read to a mixed audience with kids. This malign activity upon the marriage relation was made by Thomas Aquinas a popular ground of divorce. So, the angelic doctor says that if you're married to somebody that has a demon, you can divorce her or him. The transport of a man or a woman through the air is also vouched for by this theologian. As far back as the 12th century, many, of course, of the Patarines, which were Bible believers, and the Waldensians were called demon-possessed, and so they had reason to kill them. The mind of Europe did not become seriously exercised on the subject of demonic possession until after a heresy made its appearance, and the measure to blot it out were in an advanced stage. I'm trying to pick high points here. The craze seized upon the evil spirits demonizing men and especially women. Pope after pope issued orders not to spare those who were in league with the devil, but to put them to torture and cast them into the flame. So if somebody's not acting quite right, and by the way, by the time this is all said and done, of course, all it takes is an accusation. Some of you are aware of, maybe have read a little bit about the Salem witch trials of the late 1600s in America, okay? Well, a lot of that is nothing more than just rumors and people just running their mouths. So it became enough. It was kind of like Nazi Germany. You know, if somebody was reported to be a Nazi, reported to be a Jew or something like that, well, they could go, or a Jew lover, they would take them and torture them, right? Okay, with these, all it took was somebody saying, your enemy, one of your mother-in-law, whatever, who said that, you know, you might have a devil, and they would come drag you out of your bed and torture you to find out if you really did have a devil. And many times, of course, many of these folks died. Let me see if there's one thing else here. No, I don't want to read that. I'll need to switch here for a second. You know, Paul said, it's funny. We've been talking about philosophy, right? Paul said, what is it? Acts 17. You know, he went to Athens. What did he say about the Athenians? He said, I perceive that you're too superstitious. Now, that leads me to think that this philosophy thing runs to people running to superstition. Now, a real philosopher would be offended by that because he's supposed to be reasonable. But the Bible connects that with superstition. And the reason why is because you don't know what you're talking about until you have a Bible. You just don't. Anyway, let me see if I can pick this up. I don't want to spend a lot of time here either. It is probable that the responsibility for the spread of the wild witch mania rests chiefly with the popes. Pope after pope countenanced and encouraged the belief. Not a single utterance emanated from a pope to discourage it. Pope after pope called upon the Inquisition to punish witches. The devil often appeared in the shapes of a toad, a black cat, and in the language too obscene to be repeated. He described at length the various activities that took place between men and women who had quote-unquote devils or demons. Where medicines did not cure, iron and fire were to be used. The rotting flesh was to be cut out. Did not Elijah slay 400 priests of Baal and Moses put idolaters to death? So if somebody's got you deem to be a witch or have a demon, just kill them. Before the close of the 18th century, so now we're talking about the 1700s, popes themselves were accused of having familiar spirits, practicing sorcery, etc., etc. Leaning upon Augustine, Thomas Aquinas, again, this brilliant, brilliant Christian scholastic, accepted as real the cohabitation of human beings with demons and declared that old women had the power by the glance of their eye of injecting into young people a certain evil essence. So old women had evil eyes. If the horrible beliefs of the Middle Ages on the subject of witchcraft are to be set aside, then you'd have to set aside the history of the time. I'm struggling here to just kind of try to wrap it up. But I can't read that. I didn't realize there's so much of that I couldn't read. So, yeah, anyway. So, witchcraft. Like I said, part of this was real devils at work. After all, Satan's seat is somewhere where the Roman Catholic Church is, right? But at the same time, this whole mystic thing where they literally killed hundreds of thousands of people because they had no light themselves and they were willing to turn anybody into a demon that didn't believe what they believed. So that kind of leads to this, because part of the Inquisition, you've heard of the Inquisition. Well, part of that was the hunting down of witches. But I want to talk for a little while about the Inquisition. The medieval witch burnings were just a partial chronology of that. The Inquisition, properly known, is the Inquisition of Heretical Depravity by the Catholic Church. It involved the establishment of the office of the Inquisitor General. They included a process which, of course, they would come arrest you and question you. That questioning, interrogating in time became torture, so that they would torture out of you what they wanted. And, if you believed something the Catholic Church didn't agree with, or somebody that heard that you believed something the Catholic Church didn't agree with, they would torture you. Now, let me ask you a question. You think that they could make you hurt enough to say something you didn't even believe just for relief? Well, of course. Of course. And so in the end, what good does torture do? Well, it doesn't do any good at all. But that's what you have when you have a church that's out of control, that has government backing and an army. And that's why we said early on, that's the danger of the Catholic Church. Now, the Inquisition was authorized by the Lateran IV Council of 1215 AD. And that was that guy we've talked about a couple times, Innocent III. He was not innocent in the least, but he's the guy that initiated the Inquisition. The main divisions had to do with, first of all, doctrinal heresies. Now, one group of Bible believers were much the focus of one branch of the Inquisition. That was the Albigenses. Now, we'll talk about them just a little bit later as we get just a little bit further. But for now, again, persecution against witches mainly happened in the 1300s and 1400s. Then there's the more famous Spanish Inquisition, where all of Spain got taken under. Of course, the guy that was the first Inquisitor General was a guy named Thomas Torquemada, who set it all in place. But this is kind of how it happened in Spain. First of all, the Inquisition, the origin of the Inquisition was papal. The popes set it up. I'm just telling you, I've said it a few times, and some of you looked at me funny. There's not a worse clash of men that have ever lived, have ever been a part of a guild, than the popes. You don't get much lower than the lowlifes that have been popes. I'm just telling you. Augustine, on the strength of what Augustine wrote, which was that you should compel them to come in, you should compel people to become, if you have to torture people to become Catholics, compel them to come in. That's what Augustine taught. And furthermore, That was followed by the schoolmen. All those smart guys, the schoolmen all were for torturing people. So the smartest, most brilliant guys were all for it. So there's a long history of the development of it through 300 or 400 years. And of course, the Roman Catholic Church had killed people for 500 years by this point. But at one point, if you went out and found somebody that you knew was a heretic, just as a Roman Catholic, you could reduce your time in purgatory by a couple of years if you would just kill them. So they're deputizing any Catholic to find a heretic and kill him. Pope Lucius and Frederick of Barbarossa made persecution a common matter. And again, in 1215, Pope Innocent III made torture and the Inquisition a formal thing. In 1229, the popes commanded the bishops to appoint a priest to ferret out heretics. And so he's supposed to go around his province or region multiple times a year and sit down with people and talk to them and ferret out whether they are heretics or not, or whether they know any heretics. And then if they do, you know, if somebody just has a bad day and says something bad about somebody, he's going to go to their house and arrest them, haul them in, and torture them if necessary to get them to finally confess that they are heretics. And then he can kill them. So it's really nasty stuff. In fact, I forget which pope this is. I don't have it written down, but the pope said that a prince that was not burning heretics on a regular basis should himself be treated as a heretic. So it's like, you need to be burning so many people a year or else we might suspect that you're secretly a heretic yourself, if you were the king. So it's just wild. It was Gregory the Ninth in 1233 that gave the full authority to the Dominicans. Now the Dominicans became known as the Hounds of the Lord. And so they were the ones that got the power to torture people to death. As you know, I didn't stop with the Catholic Church. Once you start torturing folks, then you know, the Protestants left Europe to come here only to settle, to escape persecution, only to come here. And if you don't agree with them, they would persecute you. So the Protestants in many cases are no better. If you're talking about John Calvin killed people for not agreeing with him. That's a part of history we'll have to get to a little bit later. But the Spanish Inquisition in Spain. Now let me hit you with a couple things here. Some people don't realize how awful it really was. In the bloody sacrifices in Spain, the Jews, the Moors, the Protestants, and the practitioners of the dark arts were included. No country in the world was more concerned to maintain the Catholic faith pure than was Spain from the 15th to the 18th century. And to no church organization was a more unrestricted authority given than to the Spanish Inquisition, agreeing with the Papal Inquisition. What I wanted you to see was the menace to Spanish Catholicism. And what led to this response came because of the Jews. Jews who had held firmly to their ancestral faith and Jews who had, of their own impulse or through compulsion, adopted the Christian rites. In no part of Europe was the number of Jews so large, and nowhere had they been more prosperous in trade and reached more positions of eminence as physicians and counselors at courts and bankers than the Jews in Spain. The Jewish literature of medieval Spain forms a distinct and notable chapter in Hebrew literary history. To rid the land of the Jews who persisted in their ancestral belief was something that the Catholic Church undertook and gave power to the secular government to do. So in Spain, what the Spanish Inquisition was really about, it was about killing some Mormons. Some Muslims. It was about killing some witches, but mainly it was about killing Jews. Now, the other thing that enters here is that it already said that the Jews had money. Okay? Now, if there's something that runs the Catholic Church, it's money. And so if you, when you took somebody that was a Jew and you killed them because they were a heretic, because they had killed your Savior and all that kind of stuff, then what you can do is confiscate their property, and if they're bankers and physicians and so on and so forth, you get to keep all their stuff. And so this became a major deal. And so, by the way, maybe I'm just really jealous of you. You have money. You're a Jew. And I resent that. And so I could go put a word in one of these guys' ears, and they would come arrest you and potentially kill you and take your stuff, and I get to say, nyeh, 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 like that. And it happened all the time. The love of money is the root of all evil, right? So there's lots of things at play here. Anyway, again, the issue of the Jews, again, Torquemada, and once again, this time frame is known in church history as a carnival of plunder. So much was the issue around the material possessions of the Jews that they decided to kill, because they either maintained their ancestral Jewishness, their synagogues and so on and so forth, or else they had at least conformed a little bit and said that they would, kind of become nominal Christians, but they were still secretly Jews. That made them heretics and worthy of death. So the seeking and wholesale massacres of their communities, which lived apart in quarters of their own, called Juderias, were matters of frequent occurrence, and their synagogues were often destroyed or turned into churches. It is estimated that in 1391 alone, 50,000 Jews were murdered in Castile alone. So in 1 year, in one town alone, 50,000 Jews were killed by the Catholic Church. And so you wonder why we don't like the Catholic Church, right? By 1524, it was said that there were 14,500 Jews that were burnt alive. There were a total of 195,900 other penalties that were, put on the Jews during the Spanish Inquisition. Now, I can finish a couple of these things. What this represents over here is the Lord's response to this, because this is all occurring in the 1300s, okay? One thing the Lord did was the Babylonian captivity, which we talked about. That's 1309 to 1377, where the papacy moves from Rome to Avignon, France. It's so corrupt that they decided to move it to France. And they turned that French town, Avignon, into basically a gigantic brothel. Now, that was known as the pornocracy. And then after the end of that time frame, for the next 20 years or so, became known the time of the Great Schism, because when they tried to get a pope back in Rome, the previous pope who was in Avignon refused to give up his throne, so they had two popes. They had two popes for about 20 or 30 years. So that was known as the Great Schism. And I guess I can go ahead and take 5 more minutes with this, because this is one of the next things the Lord did then. It was something that otherwise is kind of inexplicable just in time. It's called the Black Death. And for a year time frame, this is 1346 to 1349, the Black Death swept through Europe. Now, you know the Black Death is the bubonic plague, right? And It's carried by fleas that a rat carry around. And so you can imagine a lot of rats around shipping and all that kind of stuff. Let me get to something real quick here and just read you some things. I've got a couple of books on it at home. And when you start reading through it, it gets just pretty wild. During Clement's pontificate, we're talking here about 1348 to 1349, the Black Death swept over Europe from Hungary to Scotland, from Spain to Sweden. One of the most awful and mysterious scourges that has ever visited mankind. It was reported by all the chroniclers of the time, described by Boccaccio in the introduction of his novels. According to Villani, the disease appeared as carbuncles under the armpits or in the groin, sometimes as big as an egg, and was accompanied with a devouring fever and vomiting of blood. It also involved a gangrenous inflammation of the lungs and throat and a fetid odor of the breath. In describing the virulence of the infection, a contemporary said that one sick person was sufficient to infect the whole world. The patients lingered at most a day or two. Boccaccio witnessed the progress of the plague as it spread its ravages in Florence, Italy. Such measures of sanitation as were known were resorted to, such as keeping the streets of the city clean, posting up elaborate rules of health, public religious services, etc. Boccaccio tells how he saw the hogs dying from the deadly contagion which they caught in rooting amongst cast-off clothing. In Europe, all sorts of cattle were affected. The Knighton speaks of 5,000 sheep dying in a single district. The mortality was appalling. The figures, though they differ in different accounts, show a vast loss of life. I don't have that much more to read. Just hang in there. A large percent of the population of Western Europe fell before the pestilence. In Siena alone, 80,000 died in the pestilence. In Venice, 100,000 died. In Bologna, 2/3 of the population died. In Florence, 3/5. And Marseille, the number who died in a single month is reported as 57,000. Nor was the papal city in Rome exempt. 9 cardinals, 70 prelates, and 17,000 males succumbed to the disease. Another writer, a canon writing from the city to a friend in Flanders, reports that up to the date of this writing, 1/2 of the population had died. The very cats, dogs, and chickens took the disease and died. No class was immune, except in England, where it seems the higher classes seem to have been exempt. The clergy yielded in great numbers, bishops, priests, monks. At least one Archbishop of Canterbury was carried away by it. The unburied dead strewed the streets of Stockholm. Vessels freighted with cargoes were reported floating on the high seas with the last sailor dead. Convents were swept clear of their inmates. The cemeteries were not large enough to hold the bodies that were thrown into the hastily dug pits. The danger of infection and the odors emitted by the corpses was so great that often there was no one to give a sepulcher to the dead. Bishops found cause in this neglect to enjoin the priest to preach on the resurrection, whatever that means. In spite of the vast mortality, many of the people gave themselves up without restraint to reveling and drinking from tavern to tavern and to other excesses, as Boccaccio reports in Florence. So you have this going on. Meanwhile, there's a bunch of people that are saying, party on, just like the tribulation. Remember that? I have just one more or two things to say. In England, it is estimated that 1/2 of the population, or 3 million people, fell victims to the dread disease. 1/2. You get it? I mean, you're sitting here tonight, you have a 50% chance of getting it and being dead before tomorrow. I guess I could keep reading, but all in all, they believe that 50 million Europeans died in the Black Death. And that was in a one-year stretch of time, right after the Inquisition. Yes, sir. Say again? 1348 to 1349. Yes, sir. Yes, sir, brother? Yeah, yeah, it's all in 1 year. They weren't getting it. Exactly. Yeah. Remember, the Jews got blamed for they were said to have eaten their young when people didn't understand what they were doing. So yes, sir, Brother Todd. Not really, no, because the Inquisitions, I mean, all that went on into the 1500s. Yeah. Yeah. But plainly, I mean, you know, remember that when the war started with Ukraine,